was limited, they avoided the topic as much as possible. No matter. If Georgie truly wanted to know, she had only to read Town Topics, which covered Teddy's indiscretions and Anne's retaliatory affairs in loving detail. "Teddy invited Ellen Morris to accompany them, didn't he?" said Georgie shrewdly. Teddy was known to be carrying on an intrigue with one of his wife's former closest friends. "And Anne is sticking at it?"
"Something like that."
Bay let out his breath in a grunt as his daughter crawled over his chest. Rolling onto his side, he said,
"I wish she'd listened to me."
Georgie scooped Viola up, wincing as a small fist closed around her pearl earring. "And still be in your mother's house? I didn't think you would condemn her to that." Bay grimaced.
"A fair point."
They had, at Mrs. Van Dyvel's command, spent the Christmas season at the house on 36th Street, an experiment that had not gone well. Bay, accustomed now to being master of his own domain, had chafed at his mother's restrictions. Quietly, yes, but his irritation had been obvious to Georgie, if not to his mother, who viewed him, as far as Georgie could tell, as more pawn than person. Georgie had fretted over being away from the children. Bast had a cough, and she hated to leave him. Mrs. Van Dyvel had found this incomprehensible. The child had a nurse, after all. Georgie's pointing out that that policy hadn't precisely served Mrs. Van Dyvel's offspring well had done little to improve relations. Georgie and Bay had returned to the country earlier than planned, cancelling several engagements, stimulating speculation, and winning Mrs. Van Dyvel's condemnation. None of which bothered Georgie in the slightest. She didn't care what New York society thought, and she wasn't afraid of Mrs. Van Dyvel. The woman might rule supreme over a certain swath of New York society, but she couldn't touch Georgie in Elyria. Bay disentangled Vi's fingers from Georgie's earring, setting his daughter on his shoulders out of harm's way.
"Well, will you come to town with me tomorrow? I can promise you an excellent luncheon."
It was hard to refuse Bay anything when he looked like that, smiling in the sunshine, one child on his back, the other tugging at his leg. "All right," Georgie relented, "so long as there's no lobster mousse." It felt strange to be donning her town clothes again, to attempt to cinch her waist into Paris dresses not worn since before the twins were born. It didn't matter that they were 2 years old, Bay had assured her. Some women deliberately ordered Paris frocks and set them aside for 2 years, so that they might not appear too showy.
"Showy or not," Georgie grumbled, "it won't matter if I can't lace them."
But her maid made Herculean efforts and crammed her into a day dress of green with purple dots that opened over an underdress of rich cream brocade. The leg-a-mutton sleeves, if somewhat outdated, made her waist seem narrower, and the pale green and cream suited her dark hair and eyes. They emerged in the bustle of Grand Central Depot to find not a carriage, but a car waiting for them, driven by a uniformed chauffeur, Anne's latest extravagance. The car made several loud and alarming noises, but eventually started, threading its way through the usual traffic of delivery wagons and stately barouches as they made their way uptown. Bay's gloved fingers found Georgie's, and she let her hand rest in his.
"When will you tell me what my surprise is?"
she shouted over the noise of the engine. Bay only squeezed her fingers and grinned. The Newlands occupied a French Renaissance chateau on the corner of Fifth Avenue and 61st Street, dripping with Gothic tracery. It was built for a speculator who had gone bankrupt, possibly due to the grand scale of his house, which contained marble from Italy, Tudor paneling from England, rooms lifted straight from French chateau, and whatever else might be purchased at the greatest possible cost for the greatest possible show. Mrs. Van Dyvel, champion of the old-fashioned brownstone, had been appalled. Which was, Georgie suspected, the main reason Anne had teased Teddy to buy it for her. A liveried footman escorted them inside, into a drawing-room decorated in the Moorish style, with excessive arches, mosaics, and enough richly tasseled cushions to smother a large pasha.
Anne lolled on a divan, in a Liberty gown that clearly illustrated a lack of stays. But Georgie barely noticed her, because there, on a table in the middle of the room, sat Lacey Abbey. Slowly, Georgie approached the model. It was strange, disorienting, seeing it again after all this time, even stranger seeing it in miniature, as though her childhood memories had turned upside down on themselves, everything large suddenly small, and she, a giant, looming over it all. The grounds were all wrong. The tiny trees were in the wrong place, and the river sat at the bottom of a steeply wooded hill. But the house itself was exactly as she remembered it, down to the cracks in the leaded windows. Georgie touched a finger delicately to the door half hidden in a curve of the masonry. At any moment a tiny Annabelle might come running out the door, dark hair barely contained with a ribbon. The house sparkled, as though seen from underwater.
"Happy birthday," said Bay softly.
Georgie blinked her eyes and said unevenly, "Did you have this made for the children?"
"In a manner of speaking."
Bay looked thrilled with himself, delighted at having surprised her.
"It's for all of us."
"A dollhouse?"
Georgie pressed a tiny door and it swung open, but she couldn't find the catch that might let her see the inside of the house.
"It's your house," Bay said proudly. "Our house. I commissioned an architect to make a model. I'd thought we could tear the old house down, but it seems it's easier to build farther along the bluff."
"Tear down? You mean to build it? Really build it?"
Georgie couldn't seem to quite get her head around the idea. She looked sharply at her husband.
"The men doing the survey, that wasn't for the water company."
"No, it wasn't."
Bay beamed at her.
"I've been thinking of this for a long time, but I wasn't sure it could be done. I looked into buying the house itself and shipping it here piece by piece."
"Bay?"
"Through an intermediary," he said soothingly, putting a hand on her shoulder.
"But the owner isn't selling."
"No," murmured Georgie. She let out a long breath, disgusted with herself that after all this time Giles still had the power to frighten her.
"He wouldn't."
"So I had my agents find what plans and pictures they could and hired someone to build it."
Bay gestured grandly towards the model.
"Your family's house and my family's land, united for our children."
"How very symbolic,"
said Georgie dryly, not sure whether to be touched or horrified.
"But won't it be ridiculously expensive?"
"No more so than building a house in town. And since we're not..."
Bay let that sink in, adding as an afterthought,
"Anne found the architect for us."
"Mr. Morris?"
said Georgie doubtfully. Mr. Morris had designed Anne's house, but she rather doubted he would bend his highly expensive talents to something so unexciting as a reproduction, even for so rich a client as a Vandyval.
"No, a younger member of the firm,"
said Anne, rousing herself from her divan. Her richly patterned skirts flowed sinuously around her legs.
"Just starting out, but really quite talented. You must come and meet him."
Bay glanced quickly at his cousin.
"He's here?"
"But of course. How could I let him miss the grand presentation? David, darling, you're wanted."
Sliding her arm through Georgie's, Anne led her to a door half-concealed beneath a fall of fabric.
"I'd wanted to conceal him behind a tapestry, but David demurred. He said it was too frightfully medieval, and he was afraid someone might stab him with a dagger just to go with the Shakespearean theme. Oh, David, darling, there you are."
The fabric rippled, and there he was. He was tall as Bay, but slender where Bay was broad, like a figure carved out of ivory, intricately worked, all sharp angles and hollows, artistry in flesh and bone, patterned all in black and white, his lean frame clad in a dark suit, his eyes as dark as his hair, the fairness of his skin contrasting with the shadows beneath his cheekbones. To call him beautiful would be a misnomer. Beauty implied a symmetry of feature, and Mr. Proyne's figure and face were angular in the extreme. But their very angularity had their own raw beauty, like a crag in the highlands, at which one gazed and gazed and gazed again. Georgie, looking at him, found she had nothing at all to say. The ordinary sorts of words, the polite social nothings, felt entirely inadequate to the occasion. "And this is Mr. Proyne," said Anne. Chapter 18. New York, 1899. February. "Annabel, an imposter," announced the headline on the World. The Journal had been caught napping. The evening edition had had none of it, while the World triumphantly blazed the story. The World, Burke's paper. Janie followed her mother through Grand Central, feeling like Polly the Duck being pulled on her string, bobbing as she went. Her mother led the pack, a reluctant Mr. Tilden bearing her company. Mr. Tilden was coming to provide legal advice, much against his wishes, but really because her mother believed it unfitting not to be supported by a man, however nominal, in times of trouble. Janie could see Mr. Tilden darting nervous glances at the newspapers as they passed. Annabel's name screamed out at them from every paper, in every newsboy's hoarse cry. "Who is Annabel Van Dyvel? Full story on page 7, screamed the morning edition of the Journal, making up for lost time. Janie had no doubt that the international wires were crackling, colleagues in London being rousted out of their beds. She had an image of the murder squad on their ubiquitous bicycles cycling right off the pier, determined to plow their way across the Atlantic. Annabel stared out at Janie under the arms of passers-by, but not Annabel as Janie knew her, an artist's imagination of an Annabel who was part urchin, part Becky Sharp. Mr. Burke's doing? Janie hadn't spoken to him since their confrontation 2 days before. The news had broken last night, in the evening edition of the World. The Journal, the Times, and the Sun scrambled to catch up in the early morning hours. Someone tugged on Janie's skirt.
"Miss Van Dyvel?"
It was one of the newsboys, his ragged jacket inadequate for the weather, his toes showing through the cracks in his shoes.
"Yes?" "I'm to give this to your hand only."
A crumpled piece of paper traveled from his dirty hand to Janie's.
"Janie?"
It was her mother, turning with outraged majesty. Janie hastily tucked the note in her pocket.
"A paper, please,"
she said in a louder voice, and handed the boy a silver dollar. She echoed a phrase she had heard Anne use.
"Keep the change."
The boy grinned at her and skipped away, leaving her in possession of the morning edition of the World, featuring her sister-in-law's name blazoned in type fully 3 inches high. It left dark smudges on Janie's lilac gloves.
"Janie?"
"Coming, Mother."
Mrs. Van Dyvel's eyes narrowed at the sight of the broadsheet.
"There's no need to encourage them by purchasing that trash."
"Those boys need to earn their bread somehow."
Janie hadn't expected herself to speak back. Neither had her mother.
"Didn't great-grandfather Bayard own a newspaper?"
"That was different."
"Yes,"
drawled Anne, who was as much a Bayard as Janie, a fact their mother liked to forget.
"His didn't sell."
Mrs. Van Dyvel favored her daughter and her niece with an expression of equal displeasure.
"Come this way, and don't dawdle."
Anne rolled her eyes at Janie in a rare moment of good kinship, but picked up her pace all the same. One tended to do what Janie's mother commanded. But not Annabel. Annabel or Georgiana or whomever she was. Annabel had never leapt at her mother's command. Falling a little behind, Janie wiggled the piece of paper out from her pocket. It only took a quick glance to scan the contents. The ink was bold and black, the writing angular but strangely delicate. Elegant. "They didn't hear it from me,"
J.B. Janie shoved the note back in her pocket, torn between a curious sort of elation and fury. Giving Mr. Tilden her hand, she allowed the lawyer to help her into the private train car her mother had borrowed from an acquaintance for the occasion. The interior was sumptuously decorated in mahogany and blue velvet, a gilt-edged pier glass reflecting Janie's scowling face.
"Don't purse your lips like that," said her mother automatically.
"No, mother." Janie folded her hands in her lap and crossed her legs at the ankle as the train set off, the incriminating addition of the world sprawling on the table between them like an obscenity. It had been on a train like this that she had told Mr. Burke about Mr. Lacey's visit. On a train like this, but not like this. In the obscene silence of the private car, Janie found herself yearning for the bustle of the public carriage, for the tea that slopped over the sides of the cheap train cups, served with milk past its prime and sugar in discolored lumps. It wasn't Mr. Burke's name on the byline, which didn't mean anything, of course. But Janie didn't believe, couldn't believe, he would lie to her straight out. By omission, perhaps, by wiggling around the corners of truthfulness. But this was too blatant. Tentatively, Janie put out a finger, drawing the paper a little closer. Her mother was occupied in her own thoughts, her face a tragic mask. Anne was prowling about the car, inspecting the appointments. Mr. Tilden was attempting to hide behind a large sheaf of official-looking papers, clearly wishing himself anywhere but where he was. Full story on page 7. Janie flipped to the 7th page. There was a fulsome account of the consequence of the Lacys of Lacey Abbey, sketches of the Abbey, a family tree dating back to the Conqueror. Mr. Giles Lacey declares definitively that the wife of Mr. Bayard Van Dyvel was not his cousin, but a ward of his late uncle, a charity child. Janie gave up pretending not to read the paper. She held it in both hands, flipping through from front to back. Mr. Giles Lacey had a great deal more to say on the matter. But there was no mention on page 7, page 8, or any of the related editorials, of the Ali Baba Theater, or a play called 11 and 1 Nights.
"I should never have allowed Bay to go abroad."
Her mother's voice startled Janie. The paper flopped from her hands onto the carpet. Janie scrambled for it, but her mother didn't seem to notice, sitting straight-spined on the settee, staring out at the winter-gray sprawl of the growing city.
"Don't you think Bay might have had something to say about that?"
Anne rested a hand against a cherry-wood table, swaying gracefully with the motion of the train.
"He was well past his majority." "Age has nothing to do with it," said Mrs. Van Dyvel fiercely, and Janie felt herself pull back a little at the force of her mother's gaze. "At home I might have protected him from fortune-hunters."
Her face contorted as her eyes fell to the paper in Janie's lap, to Annabelle's engraved image.
"I might have saved him from her."
"We have no proof of it." Janie flinched at her mother's displeasure, but soldiered on. "That Annabelle was someone else."
"George," murmured her brother's voice. "It's in print," said Mrs. Van Dyvel repressively, and Janie wasn't sure whether she was being facetious or serious. "They wouldn't have printed it if they didn't believe it."
"That's not what you said a week ago," commented Anne, eyeing her aunt coolly.
"Lies, lies, all lies."
"Sometimes," said Mrs. Van Dyvel, the words coming out in staccato, "justice works in strange ways. That is all I desire. Justice for my son."
"Justice?"
Anne raised a well-shaped brow.
"You turned Mr. Lacey from the door, as I recall, for casting aspersions on the family name."
"Perhaps," Mr. Tilden spoke with the diffidence of one used to dealing with difficult patrons,
"an action for libel?"
"No."
The word shivered through the room. Mrs. Van Dyvel raised her chin. She looked, Janie thought irrelevantly, like Joan of Arc leading soldiers into battle. First to victory, and later to the pyre.
As much as it pains me, I believe these scandal-mongers have the right of it. My son fell prey to a scheming adventuress. Had I known...
The words had the quality of a dirge, a lament for what might have been, had there been no grand tour, no English wife.
"What of the family name?"
Anne leaned forward in a whisper of taffeta and lace.
"What of your grandson's reputation?"
Mrs. Van Dyvel's lip curled.
"When have you ever cared for either?"
"I," said Anne silkily,
"have no name. Isn't that what you keep reminding me? But Annabel was a Van Dyvel."
"Annabel," said Mrs. Van Dyvel, "killed my son."
Janie shivered at her mother's words. Not angry, no, but cold. So very cold. So cold and sure. Her mother had always been implacable in her opinions, ruthless to those she believed had wronged her. But her dislikes had always been human in scale. This was what hatred sounded like, not the little grudges of daily life, but true hatred, the sort that ground continents to dust and acknowledged no cost in the pursuit of vengeance.
"Tea?"
said Mr. Tilden. A liveried footman stood swaying at the gap between the cars, holding a heavy silver tray laden with whisper-thin porcelain.
"Yes, thank you," said Anne. "Train travel does make one's throat terribly dry, doesn't it?"
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Tilden eagerly. "There was one occasion where it was necessary for me to take the train to Saratoga Springs. When I arrived in Florida, it was to discover that I had entirely lost my voice."
He looked hopefully at his client, but Mrs. Van Dyvel sat impervious, ignoring the tea tray that had been set in front of her. Janie busied herself with the cups.
"Tea?"
she said tentatively, holding out a cup to her mother. Her mother looked at her as though she were speaking another language.
"She killed him. She killed my son."
Janie bit down on her lip.
"We don't know."
"Why?"
Her mother's voice was like a lash.
"Because the coroner hasn't pronounced on it? Mr. Lacey knew. I know."
Anne lowered herself into a gilt-backed chair.
"It's amazing that shouldn't be sufficient for a jury. Mrs. Van Dyvel says it is so, and so must it be."
There was a horrible pause as Mr. Tilden attempted to disappear into his teacup. Mrs. Van Dyvel looked silently at Anne.
"I should never have taken you in."
"And let the old cats call you ungenerous?"
Anne reached across the table, seizing a tea cake.
"Don't worry. I always knew you didn't want me."
Mrs. Van Dyvel didn't trouble to deny it.
"It was your influence over Bay. You encouraged him to defy me. He would never have made such a disastrous marriage but for you."
"Oh, Aunt Alva!"
Anne made a show of lifting her lace-edged handkerchief to her lips as though overcome.
"You haven't the first idea about your son, have you?"
"And you did?"
Anne lowered her handkerchief.
"Would you like to know a thing or two about your perfect boy?"
"Ladies, ladies," pled Mr. Tilden, "do not discompose yourselves."
Mrs. Van Dyvel breathed in deeply through her nose. To Mr. Tilden she said sharply,
"How does one go about offering a reward in the press?"
Mr. Tilden blinked.
"Dear lady?"
Mrs. Van Dyvel rose from her seat, catching a hand on the back of the chair to steady herself.
"I want my son's concubine found. I want her found and brought to justice. And you," she said to Anne, "you will endeavor to behave like a lady. Have I taught you nothing?"
Without waiting for an answer, she gestured imperiously to the silent footman to open the connecting door, and swept into the adjoining car in a rustle of black crepe. Anne leaned back against the velvet cushions of the chair, her eyes narrowed on the gleaming mahogany of the door.
"Oh, no, Aunt Alva," she said very softly.
You've taught me a very great deal indeed.
New York, 1896. May.
I've had tea set out in the conservatory, said Anne brightly. Annabel, darling, won't you join me while the men enjoy their port?
It was very hard to say no to someone who was already leading you away, her arm clamped firmly through yours.
Don't hurry yourselves, called Anne
gaily over her shoulder.
It's been ages since I last saw dear Annabel.
It's been a month, said Georgie.
You must come to town more frequently. Will we see you in Newport this summer?
Anne kept up a flow of inconsequential chatter as they passed through a medieval hall, a baroque music room, and a sitting room of indeterminate style to the semi-tropical confines of a miniature conservatory. Georgie tried not to crane her neck to look back at the dining room. Bay was right. It had been a very good lunch. The linens were Irish, the porcelain English, the food and wine were French, course after course, delicately flavored, perfectly cooked, each dish paired with the appropriate wine. But Georgie had taken very little pleasure in it. Something had made her uncomfortable, and it wasn't just the unaccustomed snugness of clothes that were too old and too small. It wasn't Anne's archness. Anne was always arch, and worse since her marriage to Teddy, when her knowing laugh had become an armor against embarrassment. No, it was Bay. He had been visibly awkward. Bay, who was always at ease in any situation. He had applied himself to his food, addressing any statements to the architect to somewhere in the vague proximity of the man's right shoulder. As for Mr. Proyne, he had devoted himself exclusively to the ladies, which might have been unremarkable but for the glances he cast to the far end of the table when he thought himself unobserved. And then there was Anne. Anne, who had been all too clearly relishing the tension at her luncheon table, forcing Bay to address Mr. Proyne, loudly abjuring Georgie to admire Mr. Proyne's work, made in close consultation with Bay.
An attempt to turn your memories of your home into flesh. Wasn't that how you put it, Bay?
The conservatory was too warm, humid with freshly watered plants. Rare orchids bloomed in pots. Vines climbed the walls. Georgie could feel her petticoat sticking to her legs, wilting in the damp heat. In the winter, the room would be a paradise, a miracle of bloom in the face of frost. Right now, it was oppressive. Too many strong scents in too small a space, too lush, too bright. What if Anne hadn't invited the architect to lunch? Bay hadn't expected him to be there, that much had been clear. Georgie would have pictured a portly, bearded man with a cigar clamped between his lips, a man with a wife and daughters in a grand house on Long Island and a mistress tucked away in the Fifth Avenue Hotel. It would never have occurred to her to imagine otherwise.
"Yes, right there,"
Anne was saying to the maid in her starched cap and apron, who wheeled in a tray laden with delicacies, as though they hadn't just dined on turbot in cream sauce and veal roulade and vegetables so stewed in cream and butter as to bear no resemblance to themselves.
"Sugar?"
"No, thank you."
"How brave,"
said Anne, smiling at her over the Royal Crown Derby.
"To take the bitter instead of the sweet."
If that was innuendo, Georgie wasn't even sure what it was supposed to mean.
"Where is Teddy?"
she asked bluntly. Anne busied herself over her own cup, her golden head catching the sunlight refracted through the glass panels of the roof.
"Oh, somewhere about a horse,"
she said vaguely.
"A mare, no doubt,"
said Georgie, taking a sip of her tea, which had been brewed too weak. Americans, no matter how they aped English manners, no matter how they imported hampers from Fortnum's, failed to understand tea.
"No doubt. My husband is very fond of horseflesh, and he has the means to indulge himself."
Anne dropped a lump of sugar into her tea with a set of elaborate silver tongs. A jester in motley formed the handle, his legs the pincers.
"Not all of us expect our husbands to live in our pockets."
Georgie fought the urge to snap back.
"We are simple souls,"
she said, in a fair imitation of her husband's mild tones.
content with country matters.
Bay would have caught the double meaning in that.
Oh, yes, very simple, said Anne, dropping the silver jester down among the sugar lumps. Tell me, my dear, how do you like the plans for your new house?
Georgie bared her teeth in a smile.
I had never imagined that Bay planned anything so extravagant, but it's very like him. He knows I have no interest in mere jewels.
Anne's hand went instinctively to the diamond and ruby brooch at her neck. Teddy's gilt offerings kept the jewelers of New York and Paris very happy indeed. Anne straightened in her chair.
It was only to be a doll's house at first, for Violet.
Viola, Georgie corrected her.
But once Bay met Mr. Proyne, why, the design simply blossomed. They've been plotting and planning for months now.
Anne paused to allow that salient detail to sink in. She rearranged a fold of her skirt.
You would be astounded at their devotion to detail. Bay has an eye for beauty, said Georgie, for want of anything else to say.
She had put too much sugar in her tea. Its sweetness set her teeth on edge.
Anne leaned back, seductive even when there was no one to seduce. But does he really? Bay has never been a fool for a pretty face.
She arched a brow at Georgie in what Georgie was fairly sure was meant to be an insult. Georgie waited, impassive, until Anne, with a shrug, resumed.
If anything attracts Bay, it's a quality of the mind. Ideas act on him like a slender ankle on my husband. When he met Mr. Proyne...
Yes,
said Georgie, looking Anne in the eye, and wishing her hands weren't shaking quite so much on her saucer.
Well, said Anne brightly, Bay has been so dull in the country. The poor man deserves a new interest.
She looked so smug, Anne, so pleased with herself. Georgie felt a sick weight at the base of her stomach. That was what this was all about. Not just a new interest, but a new interest of Anne's choosing. Something to bring Bay back to her, to bind him to her. Georgie breathed in through her nose, feeling her dress too tight around her ribs. Beneath her lids she could see the beads of a reticule glinting in the sunlight as Bay kissed Charlie Ogden. No, as Charlie Ogden kissed Bay. It was there. In the triumph Anne didn't bother to conceal, the fact that she knew something about Bay that Georgie didn't, that she had found something that Bay wanted, dangling a man in front of him like a bauble, like a toy.
"Bay has plenty of interests in the country," said Georgie tightly. "His children, for one." "My dear, have you ever known a man who could abide the nursery? It's all very sweet to play milkmaid for a season, but eventually the fantasy has to end."
There was a sharp note in Anne's voice.
"I'm sure Bay has been enjoying his bucolic pleasures, but one must return to reality eventually. Frankly, I never expected to see Bay married." "And why is that?"
There was a buzzing in Georgie's ears, even though there were no bees in the flowers. This was a sham paradise, the flowers rooted in pots rather than the ground. Everything was a sham, and Georgie was sick of it, of the pretense and lies and double entendres.
"Why? Because..."
Confronted outright, Anne's invention failed her.
"Well, you know Bay."
"Yes, I do."
The two women stared each other down, and Georgie could feel the anger rising red behind her eyes. She wouldn't play Anne's game, not anymore.
"Anne,"
she said patiently, and it took her more effort than Anne would ever know to maintain that tolerant tone.
"There's no need for all this nonsense. I know about Bay."
"You know?"
The words had the desired effect. The smile was gone from Anne's face. But Georgie didn't feel triumphant. She felt hollow. Georgie tried for a smile and failed.
"I've always known."
And maybe it was true. Maybe she had known. Maybe she had known without realizing it.
It was only in stories that princes married beggar maids for love. It hurt, though. Just thinking it hurt drove the knife a little deeper.
"Bay told me long ago," Georgie lied, fighting to keep her voice level, her expression pleasant.
"About Charlie Ogden?" Anne's voice was rich with disbelief. Georgie nodded, just once. It was all she could manage.
"And all the rest of it?"
"Did he?" Anne's lips were a narrow line, too bright against her fair skin.
"I am surprised. Bay generally tends to avoid unpleasantness."
"Yes. Yes, he did. He had told Anne more than he had ever told her. Or had Anne merely guessed? Maybe they were both wrong. Maybe it was all imagination on both their parts."
"For better or worse, isn't it? Every man has his flaws."
Georgie leaned forward a little in her chair.
"And how is Ellen Morris?"
Anne didn't have time to answer. The men had returned from their port. And if Georgie had any doubts, they were extinguished in the instant. It wasn't that they were standing too close. Quite the contrary. They had the self-conscious stiffness of people trying to put distance between themselves. Georgie's stomach turned over. The last time she had felt like this, she had been expecting the twins. But she wasn't expecting now, not unless an angel showed up at the window shouting hosannas and jamming a halo onto her head. They shared a bed, it was true, but nothing more. The twins' birth hadn't been easy. Bay had been all consideration. So very considerate.
"Mr. Proyne,"
Georgie said, forcing herself to smile, to speak warmly.
What use was a career on the stage if one couldn't make use of it? "Do come sit beside me."
Nervously, Mr. Proyne took the seat next to hers, folding his long legs awkwardly beneath him. He moved like a colt, in fits and starts, still learning the use of his limbs.
"Tea, Mr. Proyne,"
said Anne in a voice like a bell.
"I don't need to ask how you like it."
Bay looked as though he were trying to disappear into the fronds of an aspidistra. Georgie might have been amused if she hadn't felt quite so ill. Turning her back pointedly on Anne, she said, with the sort of rapt attention usually reserved for singers of popular ballads,
"It is so kind of you to restore my home to me, Mr. Proyne."
Mr. Proyne laced his fingers around one knee. The chair was too low for him, making his knees protrude like a schoolboy's.
"I would like to, if I may. If there is anything in the design that isn't true to the original..."
Nothing. Nothing about this conversation was true.
"Won't you take your tea?"
With a casual gesture, Georgie reduced Anne to the role of maid. Anne relinquished the cup and retreated. Georgie waited until Mr. Proyne took a sip of his tea, before saying with honeyed cruelty,
"You have done a remarkable job under the circumstances."
Mr. Proyne looked at her over the rim of his teacup. His eyes were very large, a pale shade of gray, rimmed with dark lashes.
"That sounds like damning with faint praise."
Before Georgie could comment, he added ruefully,
"I had known there would be mistakes. I was working from pictures and your husband's account of your descriptions."
He cast a brief, betraying glance over his shoulder. Georgie found herself seized with a savage desire to kick him, to take him by the shoulders and turn him away from Bay. He had no right to look at her husband like that, like Bay was a candle in the darkness. Georgie forced herself to smile and say,
"It is very hard to reproduce something one has never seen. I imagine you would rather be doing original work."
In fact, she would be delighted to see him doing original work, somewhere far, far away. Surely someone needed a cottage in Newport?
"Oh, no, not at all."
Mr. Proyne started to gesture with his teacup and caught himself just in time to save Georgie's gown.
"One learns through imitation. I've always admired the way some buildings seem to have grown out of themselves. They aren't built to a grand master plan, they just grow. But it all looks right together. I'm not explaining it very well, am I?"
"On the contrary,"
said Georgie grimly,
I see exactly what you mean.
When he spoke of his work, Mr. Proyne's face held an almost seraphic glow. It was maddening to feel herself warmed by it, to catch herself wanting to like him. "Attracted by a quality of mind," Anne had said. Oh, yes, Georgie saw it. Saw it and wanted to kick and claw and scream. Mr. Proyne looked at her eagerly.
"There's something so dull about sameness, don't you think?"
Georgie took a sip of her own tea, forcing herself to keep from looking at Bay, sitting beside Anne, on the other side of the conservatory.
"You don't want to build a Palladian palace on a hill?"
Now that he was on his own topic, Mr. Proyne sat taller. Even his voice was deeper.
"Like Mrs. Mills's house at Statsburg? I can't think of anything I would like less. I want to build a house that looks as though it's been lived in for centuries, for happy centuries."
The scent of exotic flowers was beginning to make Georgie's head ache.
"You would like my husband's house in Cold Spring, I think," she said slowly. "It isn't grand or romantic, but it was added on to by the generations, piece by piece."
"Not a showpiece," said Mr. Proyne. "A home."
"Yes."
One he was planning to replace.
"Go back," she wanted to say. "Go back to wherever you came from. Stop cutting up my peace." "Can you construct a home, Mr. Proyne? Is it something that can be created by design?"
I don't know."
Mr. Proyne looked taken aback by the force of her attack.
"I should like to try."
Georgie felt ashamed of herself. It wasn't Mr. Proyne's fault, was it? He couldn't help having a certain quality of mind. The tea was acid on Georgie's tongue.
"Yes,"
she said, trying to make herself look less like a gorgon in a rage.
"I would like..."
Mr. Proyne stumbled over the words, and Georgie wasn't sure whether it was because she was trying to turn him to stone with a look, or because this was a man who was trying to bear his heart over tea. Under other circumstances, she might have found it endearing.
"I would like to build houses people want to live in."
"How very daring,"
said Georgie acidly. She had a house she wanted to live in, with her husband.
"Goodness, aren't you getting on?"
said Anne, rustling up to them in a slither of heavy silk.
"Would you like a cake, David, darling?"
Obediently, Mr. Proyne reached for a tea cake. Bay sat with his plate balanced on his knee, watching his wife, his cousin, and Mr. Proyne, with a wary look in his eye. Georgie waved away a tea cake. The back of her throat burned with bile. All those times Bay had come into the city, he must have come here. It didn't matter if nothing untoward had occurred between Mr. Proyne and Bay. They had been meeting here in secret, under Anne's eye. Anne, who had lost her own husband and had gone back to the one man she had always regarded as truly hers, whatever she needed to do to keep him. Just because Anne's marriage was falling to bits, did she have to destroy Georgie's as well? Georgie could feel herself shaking, shaking with rage as she sat there in her wicker chair, pretending to smile and nod, all her anger and rage bubbling over at Anne. But it wasn't Anne, was it? It was Bay. All of Anne's scheming, all of her designs, would have been nothing if the desire hadn't been there. But what did she know, really? She was imagining things, creating monsters out of shadows. Maybe Anne's innuendo was just innuendo. Maybe the house was just a house.
"Long will it take to build?"
Anne was asking.
"A year, if all goes well,"
said Mr. Proyne. He looked at Georgie.
"If Mrs. Van Dyvel likes the design."
"You needn't have the house if you don't want it,"
said Bay quickly. Georgie saw his eyes flick towards Mr. Proyne and away again. Just that small look. But it made Georgie's whole body go stiff. She could say no. She could tell him she was happy with the house as it was. And then she would wonder, always, every time Bay took the train to town to go to the office, whether he was taking tea in Anne's Moorish sitting room, whether he was walking with Mr. Poyne in the enclosed garden behind Anne's house. She had taken Annabelle's name, why not her house as well? She would finally, after all this time, be mistress of Lacey Abbey. The only issue was the cost.
"Nonsense! It's a lovely idea," said Georgie, smiling and smiling and smiling until she thought her jaw would break. "How many husbands indulge their wives so?"
Chapter 19. Cold Spring, 1896. May. They traveled in silence back to Cold Spring. Georgie felt a qualm as the trap pulled up in the gravel circle in front of the house. She had come to love the old white-walled house, with its sash windows and crooked ceilings. Lacey Abbey might have been the home of which she dreamed as a child, but this house was real. This was where she had prowled the hallways with Vi in one arm and Bast in the other, rocking and rocking and rocking them. This was where Bay had laughed himself to tears when the new wallpaper for the nursery had arrived, and a well-meaning great-nephew of Garrett's had pasted the first panel in upside down, making kings and jesters dance on their heads. There was no ballroom, no music room, no conservatory, no patterns in rosewood or Moorish arches. It was a family home, a home built for living, not entertaining, and Georgie found herself suddenly reluctant to remove from it. They didn't stand on ceremony in the country. In town, a maid would help Georgie out of her gown. Here, Bay did the honors, in the bedchamber, where his brushes jostled with hers on the dresser. Georgie bent her head as Bay worked the buttons on her dress, systematically, one by one. Behind her, she heard him say, "If you don't want the house, and put all of Mr. Proyne's work to waste." Bay's hands stilled briefly on her back. Such a small gesture, but so telling. Mechanically, he resumed his progress. Another button, and another.
"He's been paid for his time."
"In coin or in kind?"
"Far be it from me to disrupt your plans."
Her voice sounded mocking, ugly. Georgie winced, grateful that Bay couldn't see her face. Reluctantly, she added, "It was a kind thought." Or it would have been, if she hadn't seen the way her husband looked at the architect. She hated herself for thinking that way. She hated herself for picturing them together, Bay so broad and fair, Mr. Proyne lean and dark. Bay's hands settled briefly on her shoulders.
"It's not much of a gift if you don't want it."
It would be so easy to say no, take the doll's house and stay where they were, to tell herself that she imagined what she'd seen. No. No, she couldn't pretend this away. Not this time. Georgie shrugged, fighting a surge of grief at the life that wasn't. "I might have known we couldn't hide here forever. You'll want a house where you can have parties."
"Do you want parties?"
Bay stepped back, giving her room to turn. Why did he always have to sound so calm, so reasonable, as if this were about what she wanted? Georgie turned, clutching the front of her dress to keep it from falling.
"What do you want, Bay? Don't pretend this is about me."
His silence maddened her.
"You never had any idea of building me a house until you met Mr. Proyne."
Bay drew in a deep breath, measuring his words. "They're only plans, Georgie. If you don't want the house..."
"It isn't about the house!"
Her voice cracked through the room. Lowering it, she said, "I'm not blind, Bay, and I'm not stupid. I saw how you looked at him." She looked at Bay, willing him to say something, anything. But he didn't. Of course he didn't. It was Bay, Bay who preferred to hide rather than fight. Bay who never lied with words, only with silence. Georgie's hands trembled with the desire to throw something, to scream, to shout, to shock Bay into speech. But what was the use? Turning, Georgie struggled out of her dress, letting the rich fabric pool on the floor around her legs. She twisted to try to reach the slipknot at the back of her stays.
"May I?"
Bay asked meekly. When Georgie nodded, he pulled the loop. She sucked in blessed air as the sides of the long stays parted. Looking up, Georgie caught sight of her husband's face in the mirror, and she felt some of her anger fall away with her stays. In a constricted voice, she said, "I hate feeling as though I've been ambushed." Bay took a step forward.
"I didn't mean to ambush you, only to show you the house. David, Mr. Poyne, wasn't meant to have been there."
"So I was to be kept in ignorance?"
Georgie's eyes met Bay's in the mirror.
"Do you think that makes it better?"
"I wasn't hiding anything."
He might have been more convincing if his eyes hadn't shifted away as he said it.
"Oh, no?"
Georgie's voice rose dangerously on the last word. Bay started to put his hands on her shoulders, but thought better of it as she shrugged him away.
"Nothing of a meretricious nature has taken place."
A hint of humor lightened his worried face in the mirror.
"There has been nothing said between me and Mr. Poyne that couldn't be said in front of a judge and four ministers."
No, just the simmer of that tension made the more piquant by being denied.
"I'm not opposing counsel," snapped Georgie. "Don't play the lawyer with me."
She could feel him draw in his breath behind her.
"I didn't mean—"
"Of course you didn't. You never do."
Georgie wanted to put her head down on her dressing table and weep.
"Nothing said, indeed. A hurried coupling in a hallway would have been less alarming in its way than those blameless conversations in which nothing was said, but everything was felt. Oh, God, it was an impossible situation. That she should have to worry about her husband and a man. A man? It defied thinking." "If it were another woman," said Georgie, holding her husband's gaze in the mirror, "I would fight for you. I would fight in every way I know how. But this—"
She bit her lip to hold back tears as the despair and the bewilderment threatened to overwhelm her.
"This is something I can't provide you."
It was a measure of his feelings for her that he made no move to deny it. Instead, he simply rested his hands on her shoulders, pillowing his cheek on the top of her head.
"It was only meant to be a doll's house."
He sounded as lost as Georgie felt. Georgie turned in Bay's embrace, wrapping her arms around his waist, pressing her cheek against the buttons of his waistcoat. She felt as though the stage set of their life was collapsing around them, the walls revealed as pasteboard, their habitual clothes as costumes.
I wanted to be a proper husband to you. An ordinary husband."
Georgie could hear the pain in Bay's voice, pain and confusion that mirrored her own.
"Taking mistresses and losing too much at cards,"
retorted Georgie. She felt the puff of breath against her hair as Bay gave a choked laugh.
"We've never done anything in the ordinary way, have we?"
she said hoarsely. Bay shook his head in response. She wasn't sure how long they stood like that, their arms wrapped around one another. Her hair felt suspiciously damp, but she wouldn't for the world have said anything about it. She only held Bay tighter, wishing Anne to perdition, wishing the world to perdition, wishing she could dig a moat around the house and set them all adrift on the sea, away from all harm, floating like Noah above the waters. But even Noah had come to land eventually, hadn't he? Georgie drew in an uneven breath.
"A house wouldn't be such a terrible thing, would it?"
she said.
"I always wanted to be mistress of Lacey Abbey."
The words tasted like ashes on her tongue.
"We can find another architect."
Bay's voice sounded rusty. His hands gripped her like Sebastian's after a nightmare, holding tight to her dress in the middle of the night.
"No."
Georgie drew back, looking at her husband's red eyes, the crease in his cheek where her hair had made a line. She tried to keep the bitterness out of her voice.
"Weren't you the one who told me that running away never solves anything? I liked your Mr. Proyne."
"As much as one could like a rival for one's husband's affections." There was a Queen of England, Georgie remembered vaguely, who had chosen her husband's mistress for him, groomed her, presented her. Because if she hadn't, someone else would. She had kept her husband and his mistress under her eye, made them her own. Just one happy family.
"It's better this way," said Georgie,
as much for herself as Bay. In the country, no one need know. In the country, there would be no rumors of intimate tête-à-têtes in Anne's parlor. Other women's husbands had vices, too. Some consorted with loose women, others lost fortunes over cards. Surely this wasn't such a dreadful form of vice. Just another weakness to be managed, like a taste for betting on horses. She was being sensible. That was it. Sensible. This was the sensible thing to do. But why did she feel like the word was about to choke her? She took a step away from Bay, not looking at him.
"How many women have husbands who build them a house for their very own?
It's a romantic gesture, isn't it? It'll be the talk of the town." "Georgie," Bay's voice was very low.
"We'll have Mr. Proyne here to stay with us. It's a big project. Surely his other clients can spare him."
Georgie kept on talking, faster and faster, knowing that if she didn't say this now, she never would, that she would stick her head back in the sand and try to pretend everything was as it should be. Until the next Mr. Proyne, the next Charlie Ogden. Better to come to terms with this Mr. Proyne, to keep it all under her own roof, under her control. She wouldn't let Anne outmaneuver her.
"If Mr. Proyne should... if he should chance to wander into the wrong room..."
Georgie couldn't bring herself to be more explicit.
"I will make no objection to it, provided the children and the servants don't know."
Bay said nothing.
"Am I mistaken?"
Georgie's voice had a desperate edge.
"Tell me if I'm mistaken."
Slowly, Bay moved his head. Just the slightest fraction, but it was enough. "I would have told you if I knew how," he said, and Georgie felt his helplessness right down to her bones. He had tried to tell her, hadn't he, about Charlie, and she hadn't let him, any more than he had let her tell him about Annabelle. They had both wanted to hold on to their illusions. She could tell him now, she could even the scales, but the words were frozen on her tongue, even as Bay dropped down to his knees in front of her, saying, "I should have told you, but I didn't know what to tell." In a softer voice, he said, "I couldn't bear for you to despise me." In England, they jailed men for relations with other men. It was something nice women weren't supposed to know about. But she wasn't a nice woman. She was an actress.
"I don't despise you."
She didn't, not really. She despised herself more than him. Georgie reached for his hands and gripped them as tightly as she could.
"I don't want to expose you, Bay. Why would I? It would be horrible for all of us. I just want you... I want you to have what you want."
Bay looked up at her with something like hope. Raggedly, he said, "And what about you? What do you want?"
"What I've always wanted," she lied. "Lacey Abbey. I get a house out of this, don't I?"
She tried her best to sound cocky, but it was a desperate failure. "Georgie." Bay rose to his knees, her hands in his, like a scene from an old painting, like a suitor in a garden. Only this wasn't what it seemed, was it? It had never been what it seemed. "I never meant to hurt you. I thought I could... I thought it would go away." Georgie blinked back the tears stinging her eyes. It wouldn't do to blubber.
Hoarsely, she said. It might be worse. You might keep mistresses like Teddy, or have